Now it is time to introduce my friend David. There's a gentleman that came to speak at our Spearheads one-year anniversary named Skip Sipe. And I got to spend some time with Skip. And actually, it was Doreen reminded me yesterday that it was out at dinner at Thai Chili. It was Stephen, Doreen, and I and Skip. And I was explaining to Doreen how I had this vision for creating a Fellowship of the Spirit here in Georgia. She reminded me of that last night. I didn't remember. And she said that's all I talked about at dinner. And so, you know, part of that happening was Skip giving me some CDs of David. And I loved the message on the CDs. It was the message I have grown to really believe in. And it has led me to other things. And I enjoy spending time with David. I love listening to him talk about his experiences. And now I'm looking forward to his sharing of those experiences with you. I give you David Marquez.
Evening, everybody. My name is David Marquez, recovered alcoholic. I'd like to thank Tarek and the committee and the group for asking me to come back. That doesn't always happen to after I get a chance to share my experience, strength, and hope to come back a second time. So that's a good thing. I'm excited to be a part of something that's so important and unifying on the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, and another Fellowship of the Spirit. As we have a few of them out on the West Coast, and I've been to Fellowship of the Spirit Northwest, Fellowship of the Spirit Utah, Fellowship of the Spirit West. I haven't actually been to the original yet, and so it's great to see another one pop up. My home group, by the book group, we started one formatted off of Fellowship of the Spirit. We don't call it that. We call it the Common Solution Roundup. But it's all formatted out of the off the same thing, Fellowship of the Spirit. And it comes out of the same basic sponsorship family that I'm a part of, which is Mike is a part of, and so many others that have helped me, and now people that I sponsor and that they sponsor. It's all because of things like this, not just the one-on-one work, but the coming together and being the majority for once, right? So, you know, this is the time the minorities feel uncomfortable, you know. So there's some consolation in that, you know, if you comfort the disturbed and disturb the comfortable. So better to give a resentment than receive it. So, don't want to burn the paper and waste the ink, you know. Let somebody else do that. Save a tree. That's my philosophy. No. Lindsay and Carl, you guys are amazing. I could relate to so much of what you guys had to share. Those times in sobriety when God seems to just disappear, even though you're right in the middle of doing what you think you're supposed to be doing, and the tripping in and tripping out, Carl. I mean, man. So my God-given sobriety date is May 9th, 1993, and that's the day that God came between me and booze for the final time. It's really odd that it's okay that Bill Wilson claimed that, but nobody else in AA can claim that without being called self-righteous or arrogant. But it's true. I believe that as long as I continue to stay in fit spiritual condition, that it's impossible for me to ever take a drink again. God has either removed my alcohol problem or he hasn't. So, as hypocritically as I've lived this spiritual basis of life at one time or another, there's really only one thing to point to, and it's this grace of God that you talked about. You know, a lot of the meetings, mainstream meetings, what I call mainstream meetings, middle of the road meetings that I go to, that the lead is supposed to, in the format's called qualify, which always involves like 10, 15 minutes of qualifying. And my qualification as an alcoholic is very simple. It doesn't take 15 minutes. Nothing short of a spiritual experience, a divine, whatever, a power greater than myself coming between me and alcohol on May 9th, 1993, could have kept me from continuing to drink and or starting again later on. Pure and simple, nothing short of God could have gotten to that place. The first time I took a drink was on the lap of my uncle. I was raised on the Mexican side of my family in East LA for the first 5-6 years of my life. And if you, in my family, if you could carry it, you can drink it. And if you couldn't carry it, you had an uncle that would give it to you. So I don't know if that's when I became alcoholic. I don't know if that's when the craving kicked off or whatever. I didn't even know if it was beer or whatever. All I know is that for every party we had after that, which was a lot, I always went looking for that same uncle, Uncle Louie. And, later on down the road, you know, one of the things that we're supposed to talk about, or at least we're supposed to talk about tonight, is step one, powerlessness. And I was born and raised in a religion that told you not to drink. We were devout. Sundays, Mondays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, Saturdays, and that's what we did. I mean, I was being full on groomed to be a missionary, right? Okay. So when I started playing sports at a young age and started going on, going out of town on playing soccer, back then, I don't know if anybody did this, but the host league would put you up in their houses. You didn't stay in a hotel. You'd stay at the host the family's houses. And I'd go to these houses, and it'd be like this real party atmosphere, and the kids would be drinking. They'd be passing around, and I would drink. And there would always be this inward dialogue, even at 9, 10, 11 years old, doing this, like, God's going to send me to hell. I'm going to disappoint my family. And there's always this guilt behind taking that drink and being this other person. And then the other side of that was that it was a good middle class home, good church, good coaches, schools, all that other stuff. But what I was being taught that produces a happy, joyous, free family wasn't happening in my house despite all this stuff. And then I would go to these homes on the weekends and watch them do everything that we're not supposed to do, and they seemed happy. And so even at a young age, I began to be cognitive of living this double life. Okay? And so we talk about this obsession later on when we get to AA of not being able to keep from the first drink, right? I had no craving. You know, like Bill said, my drinking was not yet continuous. That would come later. But even with the trying to be a good son, trying to be a good Mormon boy, trying to be all that, and I couldn't not take the drink when it was offered to me. Okay? I didn't have the power to do that. By the time I was 15, 16 years old, I was already out there looking for it. And by that time, the craving had begun to kick in, right? By the time I had a driver's license at 16, it was full on. By the time I was 17, I was living out of my car or whoever had the stuff that I had, and I was living with people that are 2 or 3 times my age doing whatever they do, okay? And there were a lot of sufficient reasons that I tried to come up with at different stages from, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old, 13 years old, whether it was getting out of junior high and going to high school, whether it was being recruited by a college to play soccer, whether it was to just get through high school and try and get into a university, whether it was to whatever sufficient reason would come down the pike, I was never able to keep it. I could never hold it up, and it would never have the power to keep me from taking the first drink. And the summer after my junior year, I was we came back to school. My sophomore year. We came back to school, first day of school, and everybody's excited about school. I was never really big on school. And I was wiped out physically, mentally, from drinking basically from spring break till school started. What's that, 5-6 months? And I thought, man, I better find out if I can, is this a problem? I mean, I'm drinking with my friends, but it wasn't until I was sober I realized that when they were holding a drink, it was the same drink. And when I was holding a drink, it was a different drink about every 5 to 7 minutes. You know? They were holding the same beer, so all night, it seemed like. Anyway, so I thought, well, it's this invisible line thing, right? And so can I put it down? And I put it down for 5 months. And grades came up. I became eligible for sports again because I was both a disciplinary ineligibility and I was basically told I could not be involved in any extracurricular activities at high school after my freshman year because I was a bad influence on the other students. And so I smoked a lot of dope, ate a lot of mushrooms, and I started doing a Jim Morrison impression without being in a band. And but I didn't drink for 5 months. And everything turned. And it was like, oh, that was easy. Well, gosh, I guess I was, you know, maybe I was a little too serious about this. You know, maybe I don't have a problem, you know. And I said, well, next time something really important comes around, I'll just do what I just did the last 5 months. I'll just stop. And I'll eat mushrooms and no. And I dove right back in like it was no big deal because I knew that at some point when something really important was going to come along in my life, get out of high school, go to college, that's when I'll do it. That day never came. That day never came, and I virtually didn't see another sobriety, any kind of real sobriety, until May 9th, 1993. By the time I was 18, I really went from really super popular guy to graduating high school with, like Carl said, just nobody wanted to be around me. You know, people talk about seeking lower companionship. I became lower companionship. And and then and all the rules changed with the cops when I turned 18. And when it was just like scaring me to death and shoving me around, and you know, at 15, 16, 17 years old, I started doing the round robins in jail. And I was breaking hearts with family and disappointing people, coaches and kids that I was coaching, and I would remember these warnings. You know, the Bill's story talks about these warnings that he forgot or ignored or whatever. And and I remembered the discussion, you know, that my mom had with me about her brother committing suicide high on alcohol and marijuana when he came back from Vietnam, and the tears in her eyes, and I don't want that to happen to you, you know. And I remember the discussion of my cousin Ronnie, who hung himself high on cocaine and alcohol, and my uncle talking to me about that. And I remember my other uncle when he came out of San Quentin for a felony he committed high on alcohol and drugs, telling me, you know, he was sober then, he was in AA. And that was my only exposure to AA, is somebody that went to, a family member that went to San Quentin. So like, well, when I go to San Quentin, I'll think about AA, you know. So, when, right? And so all those warnings didn't just, it didn't have the power to keep me from taking the first drink. It didn't have the power to turn me when things started going sideways with my drinking. So then I start doing these round robins in the drunk tank. And you got DUI, 18, so did I. I had 2 DUIs and 6 alcohol-related arrests before I was even legal age to drink. Okay. And somewhere in there, I didn't like school. I just, I didn't do bad in school. I just didn't like school. And I was trying to go to college, and that wasn't working out. And I'm lazy. Heard lazy. Carl, did you talk about being lazy? Oh, I love work is like a 4-letter word, right? I'm so grateful to be in a career where I get to talk to make money. Because if I had to like dig like all the guys that work for me, oh my God. So, terrified of any real work. And my dad was the same way. He was like that. He was just, work was his whole persona, and it drove him crazy that I hated it, especially manual labor. That post hole pounder just doesn't fit my hands. Neither does a lawnmower. So, I don't want to work, and I don't want to go to college, and all I'm doing is boozing, and I think maybe I ought to go in the Marine Corps. And so I think, well, let's go in the Marine Corps. And I can't get in the Marine Corps for the first 2 years because I keep getting arrested at the going away parties for my ship dates. So, can't even get out of my own way. And then the judge had got tired of seeing me and basically came down to me and my recruiter because nobody else was going to show up in court with me. And he's just trying to fill a quota. And I'm still on his books as undetermined, right? And so he says, well, you can do 4 years in the Marine Corps. You can do a year in county. What are you going to do? And I said, well, 135 pounds soaking wet, a year in county, too sexy for jail. I'll take the 4 years in the Marine Corps. I don't want to do that. I want to find out. So, exploring a new virginity. So, instantly. So he looks at the recruiter and says, "Well, you heard him. I'll sign it off and get him out of town, get him on a bus." And he says, "Okay, we'll get him back in the late entry program and process him and all that stuff." And the judge just came unglued. Not on me. He got on my recruiter. He said, "You don't get it. You keep putting him on this delayed entry program, and he can't stay sober long enough to make it to the ship date. You could have put him out there 4-6 months. He's going to be back here with me in county." He says, "You get him out in a week, and I'm going to put him in your custody." So I have to live with my recruiter for a week. He never had parties so good, you know? And I had girls rolling in and out of there for him all the whole week, all the booze he can stand. And shipped me off and went in the Marine Corps, and the only thing, you know, boot camp, I didn't drink in boot camp, and that's because it just was harder to get to. I wasn't willing to drink whisk like a lot of the other guys, or the Windrift cologne like a lot of the other guys were. I thought I'd just wait till I get to Mexico when I get out of graduate, when I graduate. And then I became this poster Marine, went recon you would have been proud that you were spending tax dollars on a guy like me, running and gunning through the desert and the jungles and going after the bad guys and all that stuff, and willing to do it, happy to do it. You know, it's the recruiter. It's funny, when the recruiter got my test scores, he says, "What do you want to do? You can do anything." And I said, "I just want to go over there, go somewhere and shoot people, you know?" And he goes, "Well, you can work on, you know, we can get you on, you know, working on Cobra helicopters and guaranteed Lance Corporal and pick a duty station, $15,000 signing bonus." And I go, "No, just put me somewhere I can shoot people. I want to go in the infantry. If I want to crank a bolt, I can get paid more out here, you know?" But, so I come back from Desert Storm, and alcoholism has progressed, and I end up in four-point restraint at Triple Army Medical Center, and committed for alcoholic insanity. Spent 8 days there. Some guys from AA came to see me the third day I was there. I was in the observation room right across from the desk where the orderlies are that are 6'9", and in the room that has double doors that have doorknobs on the other side. And one guy was my roommate from the Marine Corps, who had been sober about 10 months, and he got really, really weird, right? Like, just weird. Hang around these guys in AA. It didn't affect my drinking, and my drinking didn't affect his sobriety, which is really irritating. And he was just off doing his own thing. He was doing this thing, like hanging out with his family now and making things right. And I was like, what a wuss, you know? But they came to see me. Not me, but they were there doing their deal that day. He had just gotten into doing 9, and he was doing 10, 11, and 12. He was going to the place with his sponsor where you can find people that are still sick and suffering, and that would have been me, and I just didn't know it. And so, long story short, I was there 8 days, and I came out of there, and some guys from my platoon picked me up. I had this scar right here stitched with 40 stitches. I had a wristband like this, and it told me where I'd just been for 8 days, and I knew why I was there. I had a whole little thing in my service record book, and went to a restaurant. And lady came around and was asking everybody what they wanted to drink, and I thought it'd be bad form to drink like right out of the psych ward. And but I couldn't help myself. I was sitting there telling myself, just tell her Coke, just tell her Coke, just tell her Coke. And she says, what do you want? And I said, I'll have a Budweiser or a shot of Jack Daniels, just like I was riding a bike, you know. And my friend is sitting across the table with that look like, you know, the guy that walks directly back in the saloon, you know. And says, are you crazy? I said, I don't know, probably. You know, aren't we all? I mean, you're in the Marine Corps. You're crazy, okay? It's like the pot calling the kettle black to me. And so that started another run. They put me on a pre-care plan. You guys ever heard of a pre-care plan? I got a pre-care plan. Everything I had to do before I got to see a counselor to talk about going to inpatient or outpatient, which involved 4 meetings a week, which I didn't go to. And so you have to be alcoholic to do that. And so that run lasted about a month or so, and I ended up back in the same place for 8 weeks. Well, it was 6 weeks, but because I was doing so well after the first 2 weeks, they gave me the bonus 2 more weeks. And and while I was in there, I was treated for PTSD, inner child, lost child, only child, past life regression, listening to sounds of the humpback whale for meditation. I mean, all kinds of stuff, right? I remember thinking, as we were talking about past life regression, because we all had to go through it. Sometimes I think the military was just doing some stuff just to do some experiments, you know? But it's like, nobody's past life was like a janitor, right? Everybody's like a warrior, or they're a prince, or a princess, or a king, you know? Nobody's the court jester, you know what I mean? Nobody's on the gallows, you know, like this. It's always king and a queen, you know, millionaire. You know? But anyway, so I came out of there, you know, and I got my L certificate that says my head was fixed. And, you know, they talked to me about alcoholism being a feeling disease. And in our book talks about doctor's opinion about not being able to produce a sense of ease and comfort. We sought alcohol to produce a sense of ease and comfort because we can't overcome irritable, restless, and discontent forms of the spiritual malady. And the alcoholism that they described to me that they thought I had was not fixable by the psychological approach. I have a different alcoholism. And I'm 20 years in this thing now, sober. And anymore now, when I start talking to people about alcoholism, whether it's in a meeting or one-on-one, first we got to talk about which alcoholism we're talking about. Because the alcoholism I have is described in the book. the alcoholism they described me with in treatment was completely different and can be solved by some sort of human aid. And by the time I got there, I wanted it to be solved by human aid. By the time I got there, based on the way I was raised, with the religion I was raised in, the reason I was there because God didn't want nothing to do with me in the first place. What, now I'm going to go to him and say I'm ready and it's all going to be different? I didn't have any faith in that. There might as well have been no God at all, as far as I was concerned. And to start approaching the sobriety has to do with coming to God and him, relationship? I don't think so. You know, so a program or being an alcoholic that could recover from human aid was, it had to be that. I just didn't see it happening in having to do with some sort of higher power or God. I came out of there. I started hanging around these guys that my roommate was. They were all big book, hardcore big book guys. And especially with my roommate, I knew he was like me. And I knew he drank like me, thought, acted. We were very similar. And then he was different. And I thought he had done that to himself. I thought that he just came to AA and somehow he just changed himself. I thought that the guys he was hanging around, they all just kind of did it themselves. And that I knew that that wasn't something that I could do. I just did not believe that it had to do with a spiritual basis of life or else. A trip through the steps. I just couldn't go there. So I relied on the sponsor. And what happens once your sponsor becomes a jerk? You don't rely on that guy, right? So then you have some people, I had some people in my ear talking about, well, hey, Bill Wilson wrote in the 12 and 12, rely on the group, because certainly they're a group of people that are power greater than yourself. That'll work. It didn't work. Not for me. In that year in Hawaii, going to meetings, I probably was easily a 3-meeting-a-day guy. And I never had more than 90 days sober. I never did the steps either. And that was using the group as a sponsor, as my higher power. I had all these third alternatives in my back pocket. And all of them had to do with everything other than God. And I just got to get out of the Marine Corps, right? And start living a life I have been thinking about for 3.5 years in the Marine Corps, and just go start doing that, and the drinking will go away. Or at least it'll curb or moderate, like the book says, stop or moderate. Right? It wasn't enough for me to sit with these guys in a coffee shop to be and do a reflection of my craving and reflection of the mental obsession to become convinced that I was powerless over alcohol. When these concepts started being presented to me, I was skeptical. You know, I've often said I was probably born middle finger first. And so when it was presented to me, I was that, you know. And so I would actually go out and do things like challenge the book. Right, about this craving. You know, you can't drink any amount of alcohol at all. Well, near beer. I mean, let's see if that's true. You know, O'Doul's has 0.5% by volume. Well, let's see what happens. I go to a strip joint. We need a little entertainment in this relapse, and so and I come over and. And she comes over, the girl comes over, and says, what do you like? I saw the duels, and she kind of looks at me like I'm a wuss. And I go, I drank it, and I go, huh, I didn't feel nothing. And just in case, when she came back, she goes, what do you want? And I said, give me another O'Doul's, because I just wanted to make sure that what's going on here, which was nothing, is what's really going on. And so, because right now I'm right. Right? I'm right about this craving. You guys are just trying to brainwash me. And so, drink it. I said, oh man, you guys are such liars. Right? She came back around and she goes, what, another O'Doul's? Right? And I go, no, just give me a Budweiser. Right? Drinking the Budweiser. Next thing I know, I'm coming to an alley, you know, blacked out and come out and got an empty Jack Daniels bottle right next to me. It's the same thing, right? Anybody ever been to Waikiki Beach? Waikiki Beach, about 9 a.m., there's about a million people on it. And it's really hard to look cool when you've passed out face down in the sand and just get up like you meant it, right? it's hard to make that look like you planned it, the whole thing, right? So, I finally got to a place. I was short. I had lost confidence in AA. I still wasn't willing to go to God, consider God as and consider the steps, because I knew it had something to do with God. And I just gave up on. I just quit AA. I even told my sponsor, I said, I'm done. I'm just too sick for it. And whatever God there is clearly doesn't give a shit. I know he probably doesn't answer my prayers, but you'd think he'd answer my mother's, you know? I went to Australia. My last deployment was Australia. And I'm on a no drinking thing until I get out of the Marine Corps, which I broke a million times, but they think I'm sober, the command. And so I go to the CO and I said, look, I don't want to get kicked out of the Marine Corps, but this is my last thing and I'm in Australia and I'm probably going to drink. Right? I'm trying to prep him, like, but I promise, Scout's honor, that nothing will happen. He goes, if anything happens, you're going to be illegal. I go, okay, nothing's going to happen. Next morning, he's coming to the Brisbane jail to bail me out. And he goes, what was that thing about nothing was going to happen? You know, I didn't believe in the craving. I didn't think that's what was going to happen. I thought that I would get out of there, get away with a weekend with the boys, and that didn't happen. I would drink, and I would continue to drink until my sobriety date, when I was already discharged, May 9th, 1993. Nothing special was happening. I wasn't upside down in my car. I wasn't puking blood. I wasn't any number of horrible, tragic things that had gone on before. I was playing pool, getting ready for a pool tournament. Or not a pool tournament, for a job interview at about 11:30. That's what you do, right? And I know I'm out of my mind drunk, and my head's just spinning. You know, you get, if you stand still long enough, somebody's going to come get you, throw you in a truck, and take you to the VA fourth floor with all the other crazies, you know. And I'm shooting pool, and I'm drinking beers, and I get third, fourth beer, and I crack it, bring it to my lips. I absolutely could not drink it. Just threw it right in the garbage. Hadn't had a drink since. Haven't wanted to have a drink since. And it was such a powerful experience that one of the things that Bob taught me about sponsoring was asking people if they're done. And that's a wonderful question. A lot of people had asked me that every time I relapsed, and I thought I was done. You probably could have put me to a lie detector and I would have told you, and you would have passed it. But this was a different done. I was done. I didn't like it. I knew something was different. Something happened right there in that instant that I wasn't looking for, and that was sobriety. And I was in a meeting by noon. I asked a man that I never would have asked to be my sponsor if I had known he was an active minister in a local Church of Christ to be my sponsor because of a meeting I had been in between stays in the psych ward. I was on leave, and I had to go to meetings on that pre-care plan. And I remembered him. And the drinking, the falling out of graces with God, the old ideas about God, and then coming back to it, he just told a story that I could relate to, and he wasn't that person anymore. He ended up eventually being the first person to take me through the steps. But there's another part of this powerlessness that I didn't know about, or I disregarded, didn't hear, I don't know. And Tarek read it at the very beginning of this thing on page 51, setting aside the drink question, they tell why their life is unsatisfactory. Another part of the book, Family Afterward, talks about that when the stirring experience of sobriety occurs, the man will take one of two directions. One is to rebuild himself financially, or to go off on a spiritually, and that better to go off spiritually intoxicated than the other. Well, I started trying to build this kingdom around me that would, I thought, would be conducive to not ever drinking again. Plug into this mainstream AA where they just, it's like volleyball and not the big wood guys I was around, it's be a meeting junkie, just that kind of stuff. And and for about a year it was fine. And this thing hit, the first, what you talked about, I've been through four of those. And it hit me at 14 months sober. It was like God rolled back this grace, like, see, this is what it's like without me. You've been carried for 14 months. And that window, Bob talks about this window shutting between the time you get this grace and you got to connect with this God, this personal relationship thing, conscious contact, this intuitive thought, intuitive voice. And I realized very quickly that it was shutting. And I was becoming homicidal, because I'll always think about taking you out first before I take myself out. I canceled all my appointments. I was 2 hours away. I hauled ass back to my sponsor. I was convinced that the steps weren't going to work, but it was the only thing I hadn't done. And I went to my sponsor, and thank God he was available, because I didn't know what I was going to do if he wasn't available. And I said, we either do the steps or we don't right now, or get started. And because I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know if it's going to be a drink, take some people out and then take myself with them, or I don't know. I was desperate, at that place of desperation, and like I'd never experienced, stone cold sober, sober longer than I'd probably been since I was 15, 16 years old. And we went through the steps. That first time went through the steps quickly. Been through the steps several times before, and I've had experiences with powerlessness since then, because I have to continue to seek power. And I just started my steps over again. I'm in step four. But I'm here to tell you, at 20 years sober, the question of whether I'm an alcoholic or not became really relevant in step one. And I'm so grateful to have sponsorship that have been doing this twice as long as me. Mike, Bob, so many others, Gary, that keep doing this and keep doing this. And you not only see the results and encourage you to do it, because I didn't come from that. I initially came from Snyderites, 1 through 9 once, 11, 10, 11, and 12. That's another story. But the point is that when they talk about coming to step one with the proposition that maybe I'm not. And I got to tell you that this is the first time in going through the steps that I really came to it willing to look at, am I or am I not, in a way that I had never been before. And we'll talk about the rest of this stuff tomorrow. Thanks for having me.
All right, we'll come back in 15 minutes. No, man.